ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the stoush over public hospital funding remains unresolved after state and territory health ministers reject an offer from the Commonwealth. Also, former Liberal staffer Brittany Higgins has been declared bankrupt. And residents around Perth brace for hot conditions over the weekend as two bushfires continue to burn. First this evening, a dispute between the federal government and the states and territories over funding for public hospitals remains unresolved after a meeting today. State and territory health ministers flatly rejected the Albanese government's latest funding offer of an extra $21 billion over 5 years. Despite that rebuff, the federal health minister, Mark Butler, says he's still hopeful a deal can be reached by Christmas. Alison Shaw reports.
It was all smiles as Federal Health Minister Mark Butler strolled into a pivotal meeting in Brisbane this morning.
Oh, good. I'm looking forward to it.
But the final meeting of the year between the federal, state and territory health ministers proved unsuccessful.
Unfortunately, we have not been able to reach a point where we can agree to the offer that the Commonwealth has on the table for our public hospitals.
Chris Picton is the South Australian health minister and chair of the health ministers' meeting.
This is ultimately about patients. This is ultimately about the thousands, millions of Australians who rely on our public hospitals every year. And we need to have an agreement which is going to meet their needs.
The Commonwealth has been embroiled in a month-long battle with the states and territories which argue they need more federal funding to meet growing demand. On the table today was an offer from the federal government for an extra $21 billion in funding. The federal government also put forward an extra $2 billion to deal with elderly patients in hospitals waiting for aged care places. But state and territory health leaders resoundingly rejected that offer.
2 years ago, Anthony Albanese committed to growing the share of Commonwealth funding for our hospital system to 42.5% by 2030 and 45% by 2035. In the last 2 years, we've actually gone backwards in terms of the Commonwealth contribution.
It does not meet the needs of Australians. Queensland is ground zero for the calamity that faces our health system with long stay older patients, with stranded patients.
The federal government has been warning states and territories to rein in their health spending, but the state and territory leaders point to a new report that shows more than 3,000 aged care patients are currently languishing in hospital beds across the country when they should instead be in the aged care system. Federal Health Minister Mark Butler says more data on those patients' needs is required for the federal government to offer the right support.
But the thing I've consistently asked the state governments for is better data. It's important for the Commonwealth, for example, if we're able to plan a response to this, to understand how many of those patients would be ready to go into a standard aged care facility.
Mr. Butler defended today's offer as a generous one, but New South Wales Health Minister Ryan Park says it's clearly not.
I'm not asking the Commonwealth to run our emergency departments or run our surgical wards. What I'm asking them to do is do their job. And their job in a joint funded system is to make sure aged care is properly funded and NDIS and home care packages are properly funded.
While the federal health minister says he's still hopeful a deal can be done before the end of the year, analysts say there are many complicated factors at play. David Hayward is an emeritus professor of public policy and social economy at RMIT University.
On the face of it, the sum that they put on the table looks more than reasonable. It's just that what I think is happening at the state level is that they're genuinely worried about the budget implications of the federal government's new, you know, inverted commas, NDIS initiative called Thriving Kids. And they don't want to see their budget blown on another poorly designed scheme.
But David Hayward says disagreements between the Commonwealth and states and territories are par for the course.
This isn't the first time that we've had this kind of argy-bargy and high-stakes game. The Federation has proven pretty resilient. Usually a solution has come along to the satisfaction of all parties.
In a statement, the Australian Medical Association, which represents doctors, says patients will suffer the most from this latest breakdown in negotiations over hospital funding.
Alison Chow. The travel entitlements of federal politicians have certainly been under scrutiny this week, with the revelation that altogether they spent $1.1 million of taxpayer funds to reunite with their families while away from home in the last financial year. The renewed attention on the issue was triggered by the news that the Federal Minister for Communications and Sport, Annika Wells, had used the scheme to fly her husband business class to several sporting events and had him and her children join her for a skiing weekend while she was on official business. Ms. Wells was not the biggest spender, though, with the Trade Minister, Don Farrell, topping the family reunion travel table, racking up $48,000 in family reunion spending in 2024-25. All week, the Prime Minister and Ms. Wells have emphasised that her spending was within the rules. But today, Anthony Albanese has announced he's asked the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Authority for advice on possible reforms to the travel entitlements of federal pollies. AJ Brown is a Professor of Public Policy and Law at Griffith Uni and the Chair of Transparency International Australia. He told me the Prime Minister's request is timely.
I think the real issue is what the scope of that review should be and whether, in fact, it should go beyond simply the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Authority, which was a very worthwhile reform when introduced by Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister, but which really has simply been presiding over the compliance of a very complex set of rules in a way that has really not helped politicians in many respects. And really, in many ways, politicians are really the victims of a system of too many rules that are unclear and very complicated, which don't necessarily meet community standards, but politicians themselves are not necessarily to blame for that particular problem.
Who else do you think could be called in to review the entitlements?
Well, I think it'd be a good time for quite a public, transparent review. It could be led by the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Authority. But one of the reasons why our politicians are caught in this bind at the moment is because of a very fragmented, disorganised system of parliamentary integrity that applies to our federal politicians. We created this expenses authority regime. We subsequently created a workplace support regime to deal with sexual harassment and workplace misbehaviour in the parliament. Then we've subsequently created an independent parliamentary standards authority, which we don't really know what it's doing. We've got codes of conduct for parliamentarians that are very fragmented and probably extremely difficult to follow in practice because they only deal with part of the issues that relate to the integrity and use of entitlements and conflicts of interest that politicians have to deal with.
But on the entitlements, where do you stand on the controversies that we've heard about this week stemming from the spending of the Communications and Sport Minister, Annika Wells? Should a minister be able to fly their family members and partners around the country to events, business class, to attend functions with them?
Well, I think what's gone wrong here is that we've had a system of rules that recognises that, yes, the nature of a politician's job means that they do have to have special allowances to allow them to be reunited with their family because they're effectively working 7 days a week, often 20 hours a day. But the question is how that is really organised. And clearly, a community standard would say, well, yes, you're entitled to a certain amount of allowance to be reunited with your family, but not an unlimited allowance and not one that would exceed what it would cost you to be reunited with your family, whatever they're doing, and anything above and beyond that should effectively be covered by the individual and the family to be reunited with the politician wherever they might happen to be working. And those are the types of rules that any other employer might provide, even if it's a generous scheme that recognises the unique nature of politicians' jobs. So I think there clearly is scope to be tightening up the rules here, but there's a bigger question of resetting the rules so that they don't make it less attractive for good people to want to be politicians.
I heard one commentator this week suggest that perhaps politicians, partners and kids should be flying economy rather than business class for these family reunion trips. What do you think of that? And are there any other simple fixes you'd like to see done?
In most industries, the justification for flying business class is because you need to work. Obviously, families who are travelling don't necessarily need to work. They're travelling as if they were going on holiday. But if the minister was travelling to be reunited with their family, then perhaps the business class entitlement is there. So I think there's a need to clear up and clean up the issues in a way that would meet the same sorts of standards that would apply in any other industry. But at the same time, it still really needs to recognise the unique nature of politicians' jobs and the fact that a work-life balance is about 500 times harder to achieve for a politician than it is in almost any other industry or walk of life.
AJ Brown is a Professor of Public Policy and Law at Griffith Uni and the Chair of Transparency International Australia. Former Liberal Party staffer Brittany Higgins has been declared bankrupt in a Perth court today. The federal court action against her was brought by her former boss, Linda Reynolds, who was the defence minister in the Morrison government. Ms Higgins alleged she was raped by a colleague in Ms Reynolds' office in 2019. Today's decision stems from Ms Reynolds' successful defamation case against Ms Higgins and means her assets must be managed by a trustee in order to pay money owed to the former minister. ABC reporter Maya Kordick was in court in Perth today. Maya, take us back and explain the background to this bankruptcy case.
So, Sam, defamation action was launched by Ms Reynolds following social media posts made by Brittany Higgins beginning in 2022. The former senator then argued the post trashed her reputation and caused her immense distress following a period of ill health. Brittany Higgins wrote the post 4 years after she was raped in the then senator's office by her colleague Bruce Lerman. The finding of rape was made last year by Justice Michael Lee during a separate defamation action Mr. Lerman had launched in the federal court against Channel 10 and journalist Lisa Wilkinson. And that finding was made on the balance of probabilities, the standard of proof in a civil court matter. And Mr. Lerman has always denied raping Ms. Higgins. In August this year, Ms. Higgins was ordered to pay Ms. Reynolds $315,000 plus $26,000 in interest after she and her husband, David Shiraz, were found to have defamed the former senator in a series of social media posts that I mentioned earlier. And Ms. Higgins was also ordered to pay 80% of Ms. Reynolds' legal costs. And that has then led to the bankruptcy proceedings that we see pursued by Ms. Reynolds here today in Perth.
Maya, I understand those legal costs could be in the millions of dollars, but have we heard a firm figure about what Ms. Higgins owes Ms. Reynolds in terms of legal costs?
No, we haven't heard a firm figure yet on those costs. And today, legal counsel representing Ms. Reynolds, Rachel Ross, spoke to media outside of court. And she was asked about the matter of how much money was available. But she said that would be a question for Ms. Higgins' estate to answer. She said it's something for the trustee to explore in due course. And she said it's out of Linda's hands now.
And what else happened in court today, Maya?
Well, it was quite a brief hearing in the federal court today in Perth. Federal Court Justice Michael Futrell ruled Ms. Higgins' estate must be sequestered under the Bankruptcy Act and with a copy of that order to be served to her trustee within 7 days. And Justice Futrell also made an order for Ms. Higgins' estate to pay Ms. Reynolds' costs of $6,330. And the act of bankruptcy was dated by the court to be October the 8th.
ABC reporter Maya Kordick. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Staying in WA and firefighters battling two blazes on the outskirts of Perth have seen the threat ease today, but they're concerned about extreme fire conditions forecast for the weekend, including the prospect of dry lightning. Isabel Masali prepared this report.
Two separate blazes threatened homes around Perth yesterday, one on its northern outskirts and one in the south. And residents were evacuated from multiple suburbs.
We saw resources across the metropolitan area responding to both emergency level fires plus the day-to-day business that occurs anyway.
That's Sean Champ from the Department of Fire and Emergency Services. He says conditions have since improved in both the Bullsbrook and Kenwick fires,
But it doesn't mean the danger is over, and the days ahead could be difficult.
This weekend's conditions are going to be very trying for firefighting operations if a fire was to ignite. Putting pressure on the current fires we have in the landscape with those strong easterly winds coming off the desert is going to put pressure on containment lines and the potential for dry lightning, especially on the Sunday.
He expects the region will face a trying fire season, describing the vegetation and soil as significantly dry. Fire crews will be patrolling throughout the weekend.
Putting further resourcing on in light of the weather that is coming. So that's in the way of aircrafts, additional trucks and preformed strike teams.
Residents living in fire-prone areas are being urged to have an emergency bushfire plan in place. Jessica Lingard from the Bureau of Meteorology warns heat can also be a safety issue this weekend, with temperatures in Perth expected to reach 37 degrees tomorrow and 40 on Sunday.
A severe heatwave warning has been issued for parts of the metro and all the way down into the southwest as well. So there are some hot temperatures heading our way.
The fires have not destroyed homes yet, but some are devastated by the destruction of the Brixton Street wetlands in Kenwick.
So we don't know what the damage is, but hopefully it will survive. It's certainly survived many millennia.
Curtin University Professor of Sustainability Peter Newman explains it's home to carnivorous plants.
It is a very special, globally significant wetland because of the flora there that is not found anywhere else. There are about 20 species there that are only found in that small area.
On the other side of the country, property loss has been confirmed from a fire on the New South Wales Central Tablelands. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service says three homes were destroyed in the blaze north of Lithgow, which started on Tuesday and is now being brought under control. RFS spokesperson Kennedy Porter.
The number one priority on Tuesday afternoon as this fire escalated was property protection, and the firefighters on the ground were faced with some really, really difficult conditions.
And on Tasmania's east coast, a major road has reopened while firefighters continue to mop up a blaze. Authorities have warned the public of risks from dangerous trees, smoke, embers and ash. If you're in an affected area, you can tune into your local ABC radio station or the ABC Listen app for the latest updates, warnings and advice.
Isabel Masali. There have been more developments in the conflict between the United States and Venezuela. After seizing an oil tanker yesterday, the US has imposed sanctions on more ships transporting Venezuelan oil. And the President, Donald Trump, is again threatening land strikes on Venezuela. Rachel Hayter reports.
On the Caribbean island of Puerto Rico, just north of Venezuela, the United States Marines land Ospreys, military aircraft blending aeroplane and helicopter capabilities. The US military buildup in the Caribbean includes thousands of troops and the world's biggest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, positioned within striking distance of Venezuela. All this paired with continuing threats of land attacks from US President Donald Trump.
We'll start that on land too. It's going to be starting on land pretty soon.
US commandos descending by rope from helicopters yesterday seized an oil tanker carrying barrels of Venezuelan crude worth tens of millions of dollars. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says the vessel's being taken to a US port.
And the United States does intend to seize the oil. However, there is a legal process for the seizure of that oil.
But the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has condemned the seizure as an act of criminal piracy.
Porque ayer hicieron un acto.
They committed an absolutely criminal and illegal act, like pirates of the Caribbean.
President Maduro has accused the United States of taking the ship's crew hostage, and says he's received support from a powerful friend.
The President of Russia, Vladimir Putin.
Also supportive of the Venezuelan leader, the Colombian President, Gustavo Petro.
Entonces estamos en un segundo escenario.
Speaking at the second Western Caribbean People's Summit, he vowed to, in his words, defend life in the Caribbean and said the region is already experiencing invasion. The United States has so far carried out more than 20 strikes against boats in the region and killed more than 80 people. Today, the American president tried to justify the attacks.
They've allowed millions of people to come into our country from their prisons, from gangs, from drug dealers and from mental institutions.
The United States has imposed sanctions on six more ships transporting Venezuelan oil and three nephews of the country's president. Oil revenues have long been the lifeblood of the Venezuelan economy. So, former US diplomat, now international crisis consultant Brett Bruin says these actions are putting pressure on the Venezuelan president.
To send shivers down the spines of Venezuelan generals and admirals, it is my expectation that we are likely to see in the coming weeks airstrikes against Venezuela itself.
Meanwhile, the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who's been in hiding from the Maduro government and has just been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, had this to say about the prospect of the US ramping up attacks on Venezuela.
Venezuela has been already being occupied by forces from totalitarian regimes such as Russia, Iran, Cuba, and criminal groups such as Hezbollah, the drug cartels, and the Colombian guerrilla.
Venezuela is already experiencing a humanitarian crisis. The United Nations says 2,000 Venezuelans leave the country every day, more than 7.7 million over the last decade, due to rampant violence, inflation, gang warfare, and shortages of food and medicine.
Rachel Hayter. A proposal to reduce the number of staff at Australia's most visited library has been scrapped after a huge public backlash. The State Library of Victoria in Melbourne planned to cut the number of librarians in its famous reference rooms to focus more on digital services and catering to tourists. But thousands of people, including the musician Nick Cave and author Helen Garner, petitioned against the move. And today, the library relented. Kimberly Price has the story.
In the heart of Melbourne, the State Library of Victoria has stood for almost 170 years. And after all that time, it's still a crowd favourite.
We're just visiting Melbourne. and we've walked past it so many times in the past and we've just never been inside, so today was the day.
The big tables are also quite nice because I can study with friends and that's helpful.
The library houses books and historical items like Ned Kelly's armour, and it's a mecca for research, internet access and upskilling. It's an institution that's become a source of pride and affection, so it's not surprising that plans for change were met with fierce response. Last month, it was reported some staff were outraged by an internal document outlining a proposal to reorganise how the Victorian State Library operates. Key changes proposed included cutting the number of reference librarians from 25 to 10, introducing new digital roles and reducing the number of computers available free of charge to the public. Critics were furious, claiming the plan would turn the library into more of a digital-focused institution aimed at attracting more tourists, something they believe was counter to the purpose of the library.
I was alarmed by the direction that the library was taking. I think the obsession with compelling digital experiences is fanciful.
Cricketing journalist and author Gideon Haig penned an open letter to rebuke the State Library of Victoria's proposal. An online petition against the plan also circulated, with nearly 10,000 people signing. Today, the State Library of Victoria withdrew its proposal. Gideon Haig believes while institutions need to go through developments, there's a right way to do it.
If you've got cultural heritage, then don't just take it for granted. It's not luck that it survives. It actually requires dedication and it requires attention.
Dr. Heather Robinson is a research associate at Flinders University. She says the Victorian State Library has already been through a number of changes.
Originally, before COVID, there were 40 research librarians. Then they were cut down to 25, and the current proposal suggested they would only be 10. That was one of the disturbing things. Another was the proposal to remove public computers, whereby members of the public can enter the library and access free Wi-Fi as well as the library resources.
In a statement, the State Library of Victoria says any revised proposal will be informed by recent consultations.
Kimberly Price. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by David Sargent and Joram Toth. I'm Samantha Donovan. PM will be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. Streaming giant Netflix is battling Paramount for control of the historic Warner Brothers studio and its treasure trove of film and TV content. Today, Chris Bumbray, editor-in-chief of entertainment news website joblo.com, on what it means for how we watch shows and movies and whether this moment marks the end of cinema as we know it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.